Начало воздушной операции
против
России.
Так называемого исламского государства российскими
российские
военными.
Пилоты поразили 7 объектов в провинции
Анкара
Алеппо.
Обвинил Россию в нарушении турецкого воздуха.
В Сирии самолеты российских ВКС.
О том, что российские самолеты атаковали сирийские
повстанцы, при этом заявил, что Россия бьет
появившиеся в воздушном пространстве страны.
Russian airstrikes directly target Syrian rebels who are armed and trained by the United States. Russian warplanes repeatedly violate the airspace of NATO member Turkey. And Vladimir Putin calls on volunteer soldiers to help defend Bashar al-Assad, raising the specter of Russian ground troops in the Syrian civil war. It's Putin's most direct and brazen challenge to the West to date. It risks turning into a proxy war with the United States and its allies in the Middle East. It risks alienating Turkey as well as Sunni Muslims worldwide. And the Kremlin doesn't seem to care. Does Putin's move into Syria represent Russia's return to great power status, or is it a desperate gamble that will end in a quagmire? The wait is over. I'm back. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Welcome back, Brian.
Thank you. And joining us from Berlin is journalist, author, and political commentator Leonid Bershitsky, a columnist for Bloomberg View and founding editor of the Russian business daily Vedomosti. Welcome back, Leonid.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. And also joining us from Moscow is political analyst Vladimir Frolov, president of the Left Group. Welcome back, Vladimir.
Thanks, Brian. Good to be back.
Good to have you back. And so when Russia first made its moves into Syria weeks ago, the question on a lot of people's minds, or at least the question, one of the questions on my mind, was whether this was transactional or aspirational. On one hand, whether Moscow was trying to use Syria as a bargaining chip with the West, or whether it was truly an attempt to lay down a marker in the Middle East and claim the mantle of a superpower. Mark, it seems we have something of an answer here. No, it doesn't look so transactional anymore, does it? It looks kind of aspirational.
Well, I don't actually see why it has to be an either or. I'll be honest.
Always trying to have it both ways, are you?
Absolutely. No, I mean, seriously, I regard this still as being primarily transactional. I don't think this is anything about some kind of broad great power status in and of its own right. Instead, I think this is just part of a general creation of a position, which, yes, it is about supporting Assad. But I think that's the least important of all the reasons. It is also about Russian domestic opinion and distracting attention from Ukraine, which also allows Russia more freedom of maneuver with Ukraine. And it is also about basically reminding the West, and when we say the West, really we're talking about Washington, that Russia matters and that essentially Russia can either be a problem or a partner. I still very much see this. The point is, they had to do more than just simply have one quick spasm of bombs and missiles. Otherwise, the West could just simply wait out Putin. They have to show basically, look, we're here until you deal with us.
Mm-hmm. Would you agree with that, Vladimir? Is this primarily transactional?
Well, yes, I would agree with Mark's point that it's all of the above. I frankly see this as the case of making the virtue out of necessity. If you look back to June, May and June, what they saw was a picture of Assad's regime perhaps going down under the assault of the Islamist groups in Syria. So they had to do something to bail him out. They also saw the ISIL threat mushrooming into a potentially very, very significant threat to Russia in the Caucasus and in Central Asia. And they also saw the Obama administration's strategy to defeat ISIL and then to, and more broadly in Syria's strategy per se, as very ineffective, essentially going bankrupt. So they perhaps, if we believe what Bloomberg tells us, they decided
to always believe what Bloomberg tells us.
Yeah, we always believe Bloomberg. So they decided to make the virtue out of necessity and try to force some sort of a transactional relationship with the Obama administration, harking back to the glory days of 2001 and 2002, when we had anti-terrorist alliance, anti-terrorist coalition. And so they tried to sell it to Obama and probably to some of the Gulf states, particularly to Saudi Arabia. And then they failed in the strategy in the sales speech, because the strategy was they saw asset as a solution other than the problem, and Obama didn't buy that. So now we have going into geopolitical and confrontational. They are trying to ratchet up the pressure on Obama to confront Moscow more forcefully in the Middle East. And that would play exactly into Putin's hands. I mean, they want a confrontation to create the conditions, that, exactly as Mark points out, the position to cut a broader geopolitical deal with the United States, or to engage in a more meaningful geopolitical conversation, particularly on security issues in Europe. And if Obama goes into a confrontational mode, particularly if he succumbs to pleas to impose the no-fly zone in Syria, that would be exactly what Moscow wishes.
That would be what Moscow wishes, because they
because that would ratchet up the pressure on Obama and to make a deal after the confrontation.
And is the end game of this Ukraine, or is it just a broader kind of pulling Russia out of its isolation?
Well, I think it's a broader pulling Russia out of isolation and making sure that Russia is the country to go to on almost any major international issue. Mm. That's what they're aiming at.
And the free hand in the former Soviet Union would be a fringe benefit of that?
Of course, mm-hmm. Of course.
Leonid, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think, it's more than just a transactional and a tactical move. I think there's a strategic element to it. Putin has pretty much decided to draw a red line. Russia allowed the Arab Spring revolutions in the Middle East before, but this is one that he's just not going to allow, because Assad is an old ally and probably, the last remaining strong ally of, back in the Soviet era when Syria was a Soviet ally. So he's just not, he probably sees it as the last line that cannot be crossed. But there are also all these tactical goals that have been mentioned here, and apart from that, there's also the need to train the armed forces, to test new weaponry, as it happened with the cruise missiles the other day, and basically participation in a big conflict outside of the former Soviet Union is something that the Russian armed forces have not seen for years. And so the military has been pushing Putin to muscle in on this. So there are a bunch of tactical goals that he's trying to achieve there. But there's also the strategic understanding that if they let Assad fall, then basically that is the end of any serious role that Russia can play in that region.
Now, Leonid, I wanted to ask you specifically, because you this week wrote an excellent piece on the endgame in Ukraine, where you made a very convincing case that that the Europeans, Hollande and Merkel in particular, are basically forcing a settlement on Poroshenko that Poroshenko doesn't like and Putin does like. I actually cited extensively in my blog that should be posted momentarily. But do you see any linkage between the actions in Syria and the kind of change that we've seen in recent weeks on Ukraine?
I think, as Mark has mentioned before, that Syria is very useful in switching domestic attention from Ukraine. It's important because basically what's going on in Ukraine is a peace process, and after all the aggressive rhetoric that people heard on television in the last 18 months, it's a huge come down that Putin is trying to avoid, and he's switching the aggression in the direction of Syria. But otherwise, I don't think there is much of a linkage between the Ukrainian and the Syrian processes. I think the Ukrainian one has its own logic, and it's followed that logic since February when the Minsk agreements were signed. The Minsk agreements contain some very specific points that need to be achieved by both sides. And, you know, this is a controlled process. Mm-hmm. The four leaders are basically watching it. And, you know, the two who are taking a direct part in the conflict are either hitting or missing some of these milestones. So, you know, that has to be adjusted and resolved as it goes. It's basically pretty separate. I think that stuff would have been happening, Syria or no Syria.
Well, the reason I ask is because, yeah, you're right. Now we're into the part of ironing out the details of Minsk, and a lot of this depended on the sequencing. Ukraine was insisting that it have complete control of its territory before it gives any kind of status to Donetsk and Luhansk, the so-called Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics. Elections couldn't take place there until they had control of their territory. Control of their territory meant control of their border. So they were insisting they get all that back before. And Moscow is insisting on the opposite. In the past couple weeks, Europe seems to have made a shift from supporting the Ukrainian position to supporting the Russian position. And I couldn't help but wonder, and you noted in the blog, Poroshenko, in your column, Poroshenko underestimated the extent to which Merkel and Hollande want to get rid of this, want this thing to be finished. And one of the reasons they want it to be finished is they got their hands full with the combination of the Syria crisis and the more specifically, the refugee crisis it sparked. So that's my wondering if the Syria crisis isn't creating a sense of urgency to wrap up the Ukraine thing, and if it's wrapped up in an urgent way, it's gonna be to Moscow's liking. I guess that was my thinking there. Vladimir, Mark, you guys want to jump in on this? What do you see any linkage between the dynamics of these two things?
Well, I don't see that Merkel and Hollande would essentially try to wrap it up before the peace deal comes through because of the Syria pressure.
Right.
I don't really see how they shifted too significantly on Minsk too, because the issue that you're referring to, what should occur first, the elections or the withdrawal of Russian forces and heavy combat equipment, we don't really know what kind of sequence they discussed in Minsk. Mm-hmm. By simply calling for an election, they didn't really address this issue. And judging by what the Ukrainians saying, the way they addressed it favors the Ukrainian position. Forces and equipment needs to go out, and the OSCE needs to move in to verify that. And then the elections would take place. The Russians obviously deny this. So we don't really know what transpired. Yeah. So I would be cautious about jumping to conclusions here. Mm.
Mark, any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the European position is essentially that peace is a good thing. And I think what is clear is that in part this was a sense of warning Poroshenko that essentially the Ukrainian position as it was articulated before could not really practically lead to peace foreseeably. I mean, like it or not, there is a point where actually you need to make a deal. And in a way, there needs to be some wiggle room to allow not just Moscow, but also Moscow's local allies, proxies, call them what you will, a scope to whether it's leave with a degree of honor or just simply get the hell out of Dodge, or rebuild for themselves some new role within a different kind of Donbass. So, I mean, I don't think it's that, in fact, they were supporting the Russian position. I mean, I think to suggest that Hollande and Merkel were doing that is unfair to them. I think it's more that precisely they were trying to get beyond the zero-sum gaming. Because they certainly were not saying more or less, oh, let Russia have its way or anything like that, as Vladimir has pointed out. But let me just see if I could just go back to, I mean, I don't think that the Syria issue is changing how Europe looks at, for example, Ukraine. But on the other hand, I mean, I think we need to look at the Syrian issue as precisely, from Moscow's point of view, something that is part of a strategic thing. And I think going back to Leonid's point of view, I mean, I think the transactional is strategic for Russia. I mean, I think this is it. Russia has a policy which is essentially that this is how we will haggle our way back into the big league, is precisely by a whole collection of very specific deals. And I don't think, for example, I mean, I don't see the Russian military as having pushed for this at all, not least because generals understand something that non-generals never do, which is actually it's logistics that decides wars. It's not about.
I would agree. The generals would be reluctant to commit.
I mean,
otherwise
it's about the nuts and bolts of, you know, getting the munitions in the right place and so forth. And if you look at how Russia has to resupply its forces in Syria, it's either by ship with rather limited sea lift capacity and basically a 10-day round trip from Crimea, or by air, which depends on Iran and Iraq leaving their airspace open. So actually, this is a really painful supply line. And even the Soviet Union didn't really engage in those kind of long-range power projection. And the Soviet Union had obviously much more in the way of allies, bases, and long-lift capabilities. So, I mean, I think this is actually something that, you know, although I'm sure the generals are happy to see the sort of the techno-thriller war porn stuff of cruise missiles and the smart bombs and so forth all being sort of displayed on TV, at the very least, there must be that awkward understanding of the fact that it will soon enough start going wrong. You're going to start having planes tumbling from the sky because of bird strike, or because the Saudis or the Turks are providing their allies with shoulder fired surface to air missiles. You're going to start having drones shot out of the sky because drones are actually quite fragile. You're going to have suicide attacks on ships docking at Latakia, or machine gunning of military advisors in Damascus, or whatever nastiness asymmetric warriors can come up with. You know, it will soon enough start going badly. And then Moscow is going to be faced with the usual uncomfortable choice of whether you just try and hold the line, whether you pull out and then take the domestic political hit, or whether you escalate, which gets you more and more sucked into this conflict. Generals, and it doesn't matter what camouflage they're wearing, generals always do want to know what is the exit strategy. That's one thing I don't see at the moment in Syria. I do not see an exit strategy being articulated.
Yeah, no, I see a political strategy being exercised here. And I want to quote from an editorial in Nezavisimaya Gazeta I read earlier this week, quoting now, Assad's removal is the goal of the West and the United States. Russia's support for this is optional if there are no Russian aircraft in Syrian skies. But when there are aircraft there, a compromise with Russia becomes an essential condition. And what are the bargaining chips? Ukraine, the Donbas, Crimea, the sanctions. This works, Mark, as you were saying, as long as this is going smoothly. But the minute this starts to not go smoothly, this bargaining chip fades away, no?
It doesn't fade away. It just becomes more expensive. At the moment, it's a very cheap and easy one. And yes, it has all kinds of multiple advantages. It shows off Russian technology to potential buyers. It's got a certain feel-good factor at home, etc., etc. Unfortunately, as Washington has discovered over the years, very much to its discredit, I mean, actually, wars soon get messier. And that is when you start to have a real cost associated. Because in the long term, look, 30 planes and some cruise missiles are not going to turn the course of this war. The Assad regime at the moment, you know, is losing. It's losing much more slowly now, and there will be a bit of counterattacking and so forth. Basically speaking, unless the Russians are willing to deploy much more than, frankly, I think they can, all they can do is delay the fall of the Damascus regime. But nonetheless, in the interim, they have made themselves players. But yeah, increasingly, there will be a cost associated with that.
Vladimir Marlina, do you want to jump in on that?
I just probably add that obviously the worst case scenario for Russia would be if the current offensive that they prepared with airstrikes, the Syrian offensive backed by Iranians, just fizzles out. And there's very huge likelihood that this will be the case. And then you get stuck with the question, then what? What kind of stakes are you going to go to in order to reverse the situation on the ground? I am very skeptical that Assad and the Syrian army would be in a position to significantly reverse the situation on the ground. And then this leaves Russia up the tree.
So this could really blow up in their face then, yeah?
Well, it has the potential. We don't really know what kind of forces they are going to bring in from Iran. But I would be very skeptical to see a very large ground force from Iran, particularly because, you know, Iranians fighting the Arabs is not really a good
right, right. No, that's yeah. The other,
and we don't really know how the other Gulf regions would respond to that. Would they ram up arms deliveries, or whether they would seek to cut a deal. We're going to have the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia tonight in Sochi talking to Putin.
Yeah.
So that's another case where geopolitical turns into transactional, and transactional becomes geopolitical.
Right, exactly. Mark, you wanted to jump in here.
Just simply sort of talking about the Iran dimension, again, I think something that hasn't really been explored enough is the extent to which, on the one hand, yes, of course, Russia and Iran are currently allies of convenience for Assad and against Islamic State and also the Western-backed so-called moderate opposition forces. Not very moderate, actually. But actually, from Moscow's point of view, Iran is a kind of a... sometimes useful, but it's also a regional rival for authority. You know, if you look at someone like Azerbaijan or whatever, that's really being very clearly played out. And the interesting thing is that the Russians have worked through the Damascus regime and, as it were, the official security forces, whereas Tehran has largely worked through building this parallel army of militia, particularly with its Hezbollah proxies from Lebanon. Now, one of those consequences of that is that if Damascus falls or suddenly fragments, Russia loses its traction in Syria. But Iran still has its military assets on the ground. And correct. I think particularly, I mean, I was talking to some Russians within the military world, and one of their particular concerns was going back to, inevitably, Afghanistan is still one of the sort of prisms through which they look at this. But if you look at the regime which was left in place after the Soviets withdrew, the Najibullah regime, in many ways, it was actually quite competent and quite sort of, it looked solid. Until in 1990, you had the defection of the Minister of Defense, Shahnawaz Thani. And basically at that point, the regime started to fracture and Najibullah's days were numbered. And I think there is a slight concern, well, no, more than a slight concern, is that precisely you could see a Damascus regime which clearly has certain brittlenesses about it, could very suddenly and unexpectedly fragment. And then basically the Iranians have free reign of the sort of the Alawite territories. And without any kind of Russian forces on the ground, they would have had absolutely nothing to do with the future of Syria if the Damascus regime had suddenly and unpredictably had fallen. And I think that's something the Russians do understand, actually, just actually how brittle things can be.
Leonid, you want to jump in here?
I think I agree with Vladimir that the land operation that is beginning to take place now in the last couple of days is sort of important for the gamble that Russia is making there. But Russia doesn't really lose much if the ground campaign mounted by the Syrians and Iranians doesn't succeed. I mean, it's basically, you know, the situation is going to be back to where it was before Russia jumped in. And it's not exactly a huge commitment on Russia's part with the number of servicemen who are there for Russia now is a couple of thousand at most, and a very small commitment in terms of the hardware that is there. Russia would be more committed if it actually had boots on the ground and it was taking part in the land operation, which cannot be ruled out in the future because that doesn't require a huge deployment of Russian troops to turn around, because basically the Russian army is a bit more competent than most of the forces fighting on the ground there now. But until Russia is involved in the land operation, it's not really all that committed. So it can basically, if this attack fades, then what does Russia lose? It's basically, it's where it started, is all.
It's a gamble where they really aren't going to lose anything. But and look at it another way. I mean, if you look at this in kind of a broader geopolitical sense, this is one of the things that jumped out at me right away when this started. Russia's not just challenging the West here. It's going up against Turkey, which is, let's face it, Erdogan's somebody Putin's been trying to court heavily and succeeding in a lot of ways. It's shifting alliance to the Shiites risking alienating Sunni Muslims the world over. Aren't there broader geopolitical risks here to Russia, regardless of how things go on the ground in Syria? Anybody?
I think Putin is hoping that this is all going to end very soon. I don't think they have a plan in Moscow that goes beyond the end of this year, frankly. I mean, if nothing can be achieved, and if there's no way to, you know, shore up Assad and, you know, get back some territory for him so as to strengthen his negotiating position, then basically, you know, what is there to be done? It's going to, you know, it's not going to escalate too much beyond this point. So Putin is probably hoping that, you know, the tension that he's got with Erdogan now is going to go away when either there's a negotiating process to end the war or there's some other closure to this. You know, this he doesn't think that this is a long-term rift with Turkey.
Yeah, I think that's a very risky assumption to make. And I think this just, again, reinforces that what I've always thought, that Putin's a great tactician, but just a god-awful strategist. Mark, you seem to want to jump in here.
Well, I mean, I think the thing, what we have to realize is that Russia no more has long-term true friends than, frankly, Turkey has. Actually, the norm is not to have true friendships of the sort that, let's say, we could say between Britain and the United States, apart from that minor detail of, you know, War of Independence. Actually, it is a question of where you fit on the frenemy scale. And the thing is, actually, Russia and Turkey still have a whole variety of congruent interests, just as even before they had a whole variety of regional and other differences and rivalries. And I agree absolutely with Leonid that this is essentially, I think, a short term, you know, they are gambling that this is not something that is going to last and last and last. And that, yeah, at the moment, Erdogan might well be annoyed, but it's like so many other relationships they have, you know, with the other noted world bestriding moustache holder in Belarus. That, you know, they morph from ally to at times into sort of, you know, having spats and snits and then back to allies. But the bottom line is, if you are in Turkey, you are always competing with Russia, especially if you're a Turkey which, as is now, have ambitions to a sort of greater Ottoman soft power empire in the region. You know, on the one hand, you have to work with Russia. On the other hand, Russia is going to be a rival. And so you just have to play that, whatever. I don't think there's any illusions on either side.
Vladimir, what do you think? And what about the Sunnis? I mean, this is another thing that I think is not getting enough discussion.
Oh, this is a really challenging issue. I think right now, Moscow is in a position either to ratchet up and increase the exposure to Syria or to wind it down quickly if they decide that, you know, it's not worth it. I think a lot would depend on whether they would be able to engage the Obama administration in some kind of a deal-making, both on Syria and more broadly on larger security issues. I think if they encounter the worst-case scenario, that is Obama ignoring the Russian efforts in Syria and not jumping in either confrontationally or into deal making, I think that would put, you know, it would expose Moscow's vulnerability in Syria, and I think that would put the pressure on Moscow to wind it down, or at least to keep it in the dimensions that would not threaten Russia with mission creep.
Yeah,
I think the Sunni issue is related whether Russia would engage into a more strategic security alliance with Iran in the Middle East that essentially back up Iranian aspirations for regional dominance. I think there is some element of this, and there are people in Moscow who espouse this view, and one of them was the late Yevgeny Primakov, that we should not be shy of becoming part of the Shia axis against Sunni jihadism. But I don't see that as becoming the dominant view as yet.
Yeah, and I could hardly see Primakov endorsing this. To be honest, could you?
Well, actually, he did. He did. Well,
no,
he did.
I don't mean being. I don't mean on the Sunni Shiite. I mean on this Syrian intervention.
We don't really know.
We don't. I have a tough time imagining it. To be honest. All right. Anybody have anything they want to jump in on this before we move into the second part when we look at selling the war at home?
We would probably need to emphasize another security dimension, which is you know, the counterterrorism strategy. Moscow has adopted the George W. Bush counterterrorism strategy. We find and kill terrorists before they reach our borders. But how successful that would be, we don't know.
No, we don't. We don't know how much it's going to inflame terrorism inside of Russia's borders.
To be honest, until now, after all, what they had adopted on Islamic State was we hope that the Americans will find and kill our terrorists outside our borders.
Well, they did actually engage some targets north of Latakia, where the former Soviet Union, folks were operational, the Turkmen, the Chechens, and the Tatars. So they did hit some of those targets, and that made sense for them to hit.
Okay, well, in a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and look at how the Kremlin is selling its latest military adventure at home. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us from Berlin is journalist, author, and political commentator Leonid Bershitsky, a columnist for Bloomberg View and founding editor of the Russian business daily Vedomosti. And joining us from Moscow is political analyst Vladimir Frolov, president of the Left Group. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Главная цель – очернить российскую армию. Причем, чем больше и успешнее бьет.
О изоляции России.
Российские военные, как видим, скрупулезно
отслеживают цели. Отвергают президент Путина.
Международного действия Путина безукоризненны.
In a recent article, the veteran Kremlin watcher Edward Lucas summed up the Kremlin's marketing strategy of the Syrian conflict as follows, quote, "The soap opera in Ukraine is over, at least for the current season. The heroic separatists, their evil fascist foes, and the cynical Western meddlers have been retired. The new entertainment is a thrilling and exotic epic in Syria. With the Assad regime as the heroic defenders of civilized values, Russia as their valiant allies, and the West as the defenders of jihadist barbarians." Vladimir, you're in Moscow. Is this summary fair? How would you describe the Kremlin's information campaign in Syria, and is it working?
Well, it is fair to a certain extent, to the extent that it's completely crowded out other issues like Ukraine. But in a certain sense, it was both an easier sell and a harder sell. And it's an easier sell because it's easier to convince Russians that we need to fight jihadist barbarians than we need to fight, you know, neighborly Ukrainians in the Donbass. But in terms of the threat, it's a harder sell because most of the Russians have not focused on the ISIL threat and on the complexities of Syria. So they need to, you know, to improve awareness of the Russian public of what the stakes are and to pitch this operation as something that has to do with the Russian national security interests, counter-terrorism strategy. But it's still a hard sell. I mean, if you look at the polls, only 31% definitely approve of the strikes, whereas you have somewhere between 45-47% who don't really know what they're talking about.
Right. And about 52% are afraid this can turn into another Afghanistan.
Correct.
Correct.
Religious. But the political dimension is important, is that they completely silenced any criticism of the operation because, you know, they have such a convenient threat in the face of ISIL. You can't really go out against the operation because you would be a supporter of ISIL. I think that ensures that even the critics of the regime and the major opposition forces have not really publicly come out against the war.
No, they
even
haven't. Navalny, that's been notable.
Even of Khodorkovsky, the Yabloko party. Certain members of the Yabloko party, like Schlossberg, criticize it, but not the party itself.
Leonid,
so it's a success politically in the short term.
Mm. Leonid, you're an avid watcher of the Russian information game. How do you assess how they're selling this war to the public right now?
Well, it's definitely true that it's crowded out. The Ukrainian thing pretty much because the situation in Ukraine is not very watchable now. It's quiet, nobody's fighting, nobody's dying. There are negotiations, and, you know, now it's going to be decided in back rooms and eventually in an election if it ever takes place. So, you know, a war is a great, you know, it's a spectacle. Mm-hmm. They've got videos of the missile launches. They've got, you know, things blowing up on screen. And the things that are blowing up are not in a country that is, you know, seen by the watchers as part of the Russian world. So this is like, you know, some nasty Muslim terrorists who are being blown up by a victorious Russian army. It's an exhilarating spectacle, and it's, you know, it's certainly better in many ways than the Ukraine war was, because the Ukraine war involved very uncomfortably Ukrainians who until recently were seen as a fraternal people. Nobody's ever said that about, you know, any Arabs, whether they support Assad or Islamic State. You know, the Russian, the ordinary Russian watcher doesn't really make much of a, you know, doesn't see much of a difference. And it's much more satisfying to you know, to watch these totally alien people being blown up.
Mm. So it's so you see it as an easier marketing task than marketing Ukraine.
Yeah, and you know, obviously they need the, you know, they need some kind of aggressive spectacle to occupy people when, you know, their living standards are pretty obviously going down, and you know, the economy keeps shrinking, and people are, you know, they've got less money to spend on things that are not basic necessities. So you give them a spectacle, and this is a better spectacle than the war in Ukraine ever was. Mm.
Now, yeah, that's a good point you make about living standards, Leon, which leads into the next thing I wanted to touch on here. I mean, I couldn't help but notice, like last week, the government asked the Duma to suspend budget rules and to go to a 1-year budget cycle, which was a sign that they're in trouble. As the economy declines, Russia continues to embark on costly military adventures. We seem to know why this is the case. But one has to wonder, and Mark, this is something you and I talked a little bit about off mic, using war as a tool of mobilization. This is like part two. Ukraine was part one, and here we got the sequel. How long can they continue doing this as the economy continues to slide?
Well, I think at the moment, this is not that costly a military adventure. In any terms. I mean, if we go back to the sort of propaganda dimension, I mean, obviously, you know, we're not naive. We know that East or West, any such war gets the full cinematic spin at first. It doesn't matter who's doing it. This is not distinctively Russian. So if you try and think, well, okay, what is distinctively Russian about this situation? I mean, one is precisely the way it squeezes away Ukraine from the public consciousness, which obviously, if nothing else, helps basically conceal the fact that actually Ukraine is not going particularly well, nor is it going badly, but it's stuck. And it also gives the Kremlin more room for maneuver there. So it's not, as it were, doing so under any kind of public spotlight. And this particular war is one exactly, in some ways, it's safely distant, and it's sort of people who are you're happy seeing blown away. But on the other hand, no one really cares about Syria. This is why they have to really hype the jihadist angle, because it's not actually, I think, as if Russians feel a loamy attachment to the Syrian people. But the point is the narrative, the propaganda narrative that the Kremlin chooses to spin gives it certain advantages, but also locks it in. It actually creates political inflexibilities. And if you think about, as it were, what, to me, from sort of not being in Moscow at the moment, but, you know, as near as I can see from the media, I mean, there seem to be kind of three threads that are emerging. One is that it's triumphant. All this stuff about, you know, hundreds of you know, mercenaries are already streaming out of Syria and so forth. They're very quickly actually setting quite a high bar for actually how successful these operations are, which means it becomes a bit harder when later on you have to say, oh, and we're stuck and we have to send some troops and whatever else. Secondly, it's that it's safe. Again, at the moment, it's all this nice arm's length. It's you know, it's cruise missiles, it's drones, or it's, you know, bombers, which they count them all out. They count them all back again. Everything's fine. We haven't yet got the situation where a plane is downed and we see a Russian pilot being beheaded on video, on online video, that kind of thing. So again, I think at the moment, this is precisely because of the Afghan parallel. I mean, it's not going to become an Afghanistan. I mean, the Soviets deployed 100,000 people at any one time in Afghanistan. There's just no way Russia could deploy anything like that, or would. But the point is, I think at the moment, that I think the Russian people are expecting it to be kept safe. And the third thing is actually that basically that the Russians are well regarded. I mean, I think that seems to be coming through the propaganda that, well, yes, the West doesn't like it, but basically all right-thinking people know that we're doing the proper thing, and all good Syrians think we're doing the proper thing. So I think at the moment, it's not that expensive in economic terms. Yeah, of course, there's a certain amount of ordnance being expended. But the point is, Russia needs to keep its defense industries ticking over. It's going to be buying these things anyway, really. So you might as well shoot them at jihadists. But I think it's more that it's building in potential political costs. And that's where I think the mobilization becomes a problem, because the world does not stand still. You don't get to completely define, even if you control all the TV outlets, you don't get to completely sort of define how the world will evolve. And we know that unpredictable things are going to happen and bad things are going to happen. And it's how Moscow then has to deal with the fallout from that.
Vladimir?
Well, I think one of the things that that Russia is making is they're making the Dick Cheney mistake, which is presenting the operation as a cakewalk. And as Mark pointed out, that's not going to happen. There'll be complications. And they're clearly not preparing the public for the complications. They're actually trivializing the war by focusing on, you know, stuff like, you know, how they're feeding their pilots and their soldiers. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, they're really overdoing this. Another problem that I see with maintaining this propaganda momentum is what is the vision of victory? How do you see victory in this operation? What if the Islamic State is not defeated? What if something happens to the brittle Assad regime and there are defections and there are collapses of the front in certain areas? So how do you present, keep selling it as a victorious campaign? And the interconnected thing is that they're not selling a viable exit strategy. They're not saying, well, this is how we see this ending and our participation ending, and this would be the criteria by which we would judge the operation as a success. So they're selling an open-ended commitment, and that's a problem.
Leonid, would you agree with that?
Yeah, to an extent. I think they will start selling an exit strategy when an exit strategy becomes available. In any war, you know, there's a risk that you're going to lose, or at least that you're not going to win. And obviously, you know, by going into this conflict, they are, you know, Putin is taking a risk. But it's a calculated risk in that Assad has, you know, withstood 4 years of war without much outside help. So now they're figuring, you know, with their help, he's going to do better than he did before they entered. So now, you know, the reason they're not selling an exit strategy is they don't feel that they need to do that. And now if things turn ugly and Assad keeps losing and keeps losing territory and you know, giving up more towns and retreating as he was before Russia intervened, despite, you know, the Russian support from the air, then they have to think about how to, you know, which exit strategy to choose first and then how to sell the chosen strategy. Right. Either they're going to, you know, pull out and reduce their presence and, you know, quietly let Assad slip, which I don't really believe is going to happen, or they're going to ramp it up and send, you know, 5,000, you know, special troops, which is another strategy that you need to sell differently from the first one, or there's, you know, there are negotiations, which, you know, it's pretty easy to imagine how that's going to be sold as a Russian victory, because, you know, we intervened and now the sides are talking. So They're not sure what's going to happen. It's a risk. It's a military campaign. It could go, you know, a number of different ways. So that's why we can't see them right now preparing to sell a certain line. They don't have one.
Mm-hmm. Mark, I saw you writing, and whenever you are writing, it's a sure sign you have something very intelligent to say, so let's have it.
Well, I mean, just before I start with anything that might potentially be intelligent, I must say, I think it was an excellent point from Vladimir, and just deeply depressing to think that, in fact, of all the people that the Kremlin could steal a march from, Dick Cheney is the one that they chose as a role model. I think I want to sort of slightly sort of challenge part of what Leonid was saying about this being a sort of a calculated risk, because I'm not sure quite how well they have really calculated this. I mean, the Assad regime has withstood for years, yes, but in the same way as someone falling out of a window can fly successfully until they hit the ground. I mean, the bottom line was Assad was losing, which is why they really, I think, had to move in now. It wasn't just because of the convenience of that Putin could go to the UN and make a big splash of it. I think there was a sense that if we're going to do something, we better do it now. Because in war, momentum is exceedingly important. And clearly, momentum was actually turning against the Assad regime. You had less and less ground being held by the government. They were having to expand their conscription within the Alawite population, which is the sort of the bedrock of the Assad regime support and so forth. And so I think this is the thing. Yes, of course, any war you go into, there's a chance that you're going to lose. But this is a war, this is not a sort of an existential war because someone has rolled over your border. This is one in which actually Moscow chose to intervene. It's what states do, especially states that wish to assert themselves as global or great powers.
A war but of choice.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but this is, I mean, and just as Iraq or indeed Afghanistan were deeply stupid wars, because America didn't properly think through, well, what is going to be the end game? Here, I mean, saving Assad, the regime, is not only hard to imagine, it is also completely open-ended. Defeating ISIS, it's like, you know, we're back into kind of global war on terror notions. The fact is that sort of, you know, it's not just about structures which frankly, are, you know, have already shown that they can endure a lot of pounding. It's also about the ideas, the ideologies, the principles that underlie them and so forth, which you can't cruise missile your way through to defeating. It's hard on the one hand to see any kind of meaningful, positive outcome for the Russians, except if this allows them precisely to broker some kind of new structure in Syria, which will probably not include Assad. And Assad, I'm sure, you know, there's some nice empty villas these days outside in Barvikha. But, you know, he can join the community of exiled dictators, and, you know, some new Alawite figure can emerge with a sort of government of national reconciliation that includes everyone but ISIS or something. Who knows? I mean, at the moment, this is just science fiction. This is just speculation. But, and that, again, says something about the prospects of this. Or you have to start talking about massive escalations. I mean, you know, 5,000 special troops. Well, Russia doesn't have 5,000 special troops that are deployable, burning a hole in its pocket. If it was going to do that, again, it'll have to dramatically downscale its commitment to the Donbass, which maybe it's doing already. But also it won't have the reserve if Kiev thinks, to hell with this, let's actually just win this war rather than negotiate our way around it. I mean, what I'm trying to get at is, on the one hand, this was a diplomatic coup de main, which actually has been very successful. It's put America very much on the back foot because it feels it has to respond and doesn't know how to do so. It's given the Russian population some new story, some new sort of kinetic soap opera to distract it exactly from Ukraine or whatever. So in the short term, very effective. But again, going back to this tactician versus strategist business, I can't see how it ends well for Russia.
This is the problem.
And what are the points? I'm not convinced that anyone in Moscow, in the, you know, at least within the Kremlin or the sort of the collective Kremlin, really has some sense of where it goes. I would love to think that was not the case. I would love to think that someone does have a grand plan. But if so, they are being incredibly tight-lipped about it, and they're not even signalling it through the usual ways in which actually the Kremlin sends out its messages.
Mm-hmm. Leonid?
Well, they are. I mean, they are constantly signaling that they, you know, that they want to end this through negotiation. And they're just hoping they're going to force talks by through military success. And if that doesn't happen, then, you know, it's pretty clear that they don't really have a further plan. Mm. It would end well if any sort of settlement that didn't involve immediately toppling Assad went through. You know, that would be desirable outcome for Putin. He would have, you know, he would be seen to have stood by his ally, and he'd, you know, still have a chance to, you know, form a good relationship with any successor government, because he'd be part of the process that would bring it to power. So that's what, you know, that's what the plan is, and they've signaled it. They've mentioned that they want a negotiated end to the war. Whether the action that, you know, the military action that is taking place there is leading to that outcome is doubtful, because of, you know, because of the Western response and the Turkish response and the, you know, the vicissitudes of war, you know, whether the Assad army is capable of fighting anymore after 4 years of you know, being pushed back. There are a lot of ifs, but it's a, you know, it's a military conflict. That's, you know, that's the way it should be. It's never exactly planned out to, you know, to the last detail.
Well, there's one more thing I wanted to hit on. We're bumping up against time, but there is one more thing I wanted to hit on here. It's been almost 2 years now where it's been constant military mobilization of the population in Russia behind one campaign or the other. Ukraine's winding down. Now we have Syria. Sooner or later, this is gonna wind up one way or the other, right? Are we in for more? I mean, is this the new normal, constant war mobilization? Vladimir, what do you think? Because it's been 2 years. It's hard for me to remember now back to what it was like covering Russia before it was on constant war mobilization footing. Is this how they're going to continue to pacify the population? I mean, I'm fond on this podcast of using the cocaine analogy. It's like they keep giving the population these hits of cocaine, first from Ukraine and now from Syria. What's next? Does this continue forever?
Oh, it's tempting to you. To view the situation in those terms, but I'm skeptical. Mm. I still view the Syrian situation and the Syrian escalation as the necessity. Mm. Exactly, because the Assad regime was on the brink of being toppled and losing the war, they had to act immediately. So it's distracting from Ukraine and from domestic economic problems is a side benefit. Mm. But it was not the primary objective of jumping into Syria. Mm. So whether they would find something else, well, they have two campaigns now, one in Ukraine, one in Syria. And possibly, if we look at the statements, possibly Iraq. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what else can they find? Libya? There's also Islamic State ISIL forces in Libya. Should they go to Libya? I doubt that. That's just not sustainable. Further home? Well, things are heating up in Tajikistan and Afghanistan. If there is some kind of invasion by Taliban into Tajikistan, they would have to respond. They have a treaty. They have to deal with this. But purposefully instigating some hostilities in Central Asia, I don't think that they are that stupid. I don't see the need for that to justify, to shore up their domestic position. They're still strong. That will not be the driver if we see hostilities in Central Asia, not the driver.
Mark, Leonid, last words before we wrap it up on this?
I mean, I just quickly say that I think we have to be sort of cautious about how far there is a really active war mobilization. Again, I mean, you know, Vladimir's there on the ground, but even if I think of my time there this summer and before, yes, of course, there's St. George's ribbons around, there's army stores and combat chic. But this is not a country that really feels at war, especially when you don't have your television set on. You know, I mean, one can just as easily say, when was the last time that the United States was at peace? I think it's more that actually what the government needs is spectacle. Now, war makes for a good spectacle, but then again, you know, so too did Sochi, so did other things. I mean, I think it has alternative ways that it can mobilize. I absolutely agree with Vladimir that there's no obvious or desirable conflicts that are on the horizon that I think we can really at the moment see the Kremlin would be thinking about. Oh, let's also agitate for some conflagration there as well.
Leonid, last word to you before we close it out.
Well, I absolutely agree with what Mark and Vladimir said. I don't see a potential new conflict either. And I don't think, as Mark says, I don't think Russians feel at war. The mobilization is very much like in playing a computer game more than, you know, taking part in action.
Well, actual mobilization would be quite unpopular, I would add.
No, I was thinking more, as Mark said, spectacle is maybe would be a better term than, and you're right, there are plenty of domestic spectacles that can be used in lieu of a foreign conflict. Well, I promised everybody an all-star lineup today. I think we delivered, and that's all we have time for today, so we'll wrap it up. I'd like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City has been co-host Mark Galeotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Joining us from Berlin has been journalist, author, and political commentator Leonid Bershitsky, a columnist for Bloomberg View, and founding editor of the Russian business daily Vedomosti. And joining us from Moscow has been political analyst Vladimir Frolov, president of the Lef Group. Thank you, gentlemen, for an enlightening discussion.
Good to be back.
Good to have
good
you
to
back.
Be back.
And I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Kancheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally indispensable and totally awesome Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week, and now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.